Good evening. It has been a busy and a difficult day. In addition to the first court appearance for the ex-officer, police officer charged in Dante Wright's killing in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, and the trial in Minneapolis of ex-officer Derek Chauvin in the killing of George Floyd, video emerged today from Chicago in the fatal police shooting of Adam Toledo, a 13-year-old Latino. Of course, all of the cases are different. Each scenario and each investigation is unique, and we'll treat each of them as such. There's no denying the country is on edge. We'll be joined by the Toledo family attorney. Our legal and law enforcement analysts are here as well, including former D.C. and Philadelphia Police Chief Charles Ramsey, who's especially qualified to talk about what is and what isn't appropriate use of deadly force. We want to start, though, where Dante Wright was killed, Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, a town that has seen four straight nights of protests and arrests, and it looks to be bracing for a fifth. Miguel Marquez is there. So what are you seeing right now, Miguel?
Yeah, it very much does look like it's going to be a fifth night of some sort of protest. I want to show you what the crowd is doing right now. Look, people are out here rallying. They're out here in support of Dante Wright. They certainly want to see justice for him. They want to see changes to the police force as well and to the way policing is done. They are handing out umbrellas. They're handing out eye protection. They are clearly preparing for a night of making a very emphatic point to the police here of the changes that they want to see to the entire system. The police, for their side, have put in extra barriers, cement barriers and fencing all the way up and down the station itself and even on some of the side streets here. So both sides sort of getting ready for another night here. But I got to tell you that police have gotten much better at moving in very quickly when curfews go into effect and moving people, breaking up the protests and moving people out. Anderson?
Is there a curfew in place tonight, as there has been over the past couple of days?
There is for Brooklyn Center. It's been a little patchy around the entire Minneapolis area. There's not for the city of Minneapolis. There's not for Brooklyn Park, which is just east of where we are. But for Brooklyn Center, there is one starting at 10 p.m. The curfew aside, though, if the police decide that it's an unlawful gathering, they will announce that and start using means to try to move the crowd on as well. So we'll have to see how the night progresses, but it's always a little different, and we suspect that this crowd will be back again and again and again. Anderson?
Miguel Marquez, appreciate it. Now Chicago and the killing of a 13-year-old, Adam Toledo. A warning first, this is an especially difficult subject. Our Andy Kay has the story.
It's hard to watch the final moments of a 13-year-old boy's life. This Chicago police officer's body cam appears to show the teenage boy with what police say is a gun in his right hand, turning toward the officer. In less than a second, he's fatally shot, a single bullet to the chest from the officer's gun. It happened on March 29th. Chicago police say officers were responding to a shots fired call on the city's west side when they say they came upon 13-year-old Adam Toledo and a 21-year-old man walking down an alley. The officer's body cam footage shows Toledo fleeing and the officer pursuing the teenager on foot, yelling at him to stop.
Please stop! Stop right now! Hey, show me your f***ing hand! Stop it!
What happened next is still under investigation, but police say the body cam video shows Toledo with a gun in his right hand as the officer once again yells for him to stop. As the boy turns around, the officer opens fire.
I've seen no evidence whatsoever that Adam Toledo shot at the police.
Police later tweeted out this picture of a gun they say was recovered from the scene, and prosecutors say Toledo's right hand tested positive for gunshot residue. But the family's attorney insisting the boy was not holding a gun when he was shot.
Adam, during his last second of life, did not have a gun in his hand. The officer screamed at him, "Show me your hands." Adam complied, turned around. His hands were empty when he was shot in the chest at the hands of the officer.
She later suggested Adam Toledo may have had a gun at some point, but tossed it. On the video, the unnamed officer who shot the boy immediately calls for an ambulance and tries to render aid. Police say 21-year-old Ruben Roman was with the teenager and is in custody. The charges against him include felony reckless discharge of a firearm and felony endangerment of a child. Adam Toledo's family first saw the body cam video of the shooting on Tuesday. The boy's mother sobbing as she questioned why anyone would kill her baby. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot also saw the video before it was released.
It was excruciating. Watching the body cam footage, which shows young Adam after he's shot, is extremely difficult.
The boy's family initially asked that the video not be made public right away, but later attorneys for the family and the Chicago mayor's office agreed to release the video along with a slowed down version of it.
He's running through an alley. The raw video footage is extraordinarily jumpy. It's really hard to see anything. Providing kind of a slowed down frame by frame opportunity to see what happened is going to be helpful to members of the public.
Adam Toledo's mother describes her son as happy, saying he loved animals, building Legos, and playing with Hot Wheels. Now, so many questions about how he ended up dead in a Chicago alley at the hands of police. Randy Kay, CNN, Palm Beach County, Florida.
Well, joining us now is the attorney you saw in Randy's report, Adina Weiss-Ortiz, who represents the Toledo family. Ms. Weiss-Ortiz, we appreciate you joining us. So police say the footage shows that less than 1 second passes between the time when Toledo is seen with a gun and the officer fires a shot. If that is true, would the officer's actions be justified?
Well, let's clarify what's on the videos. There is a slowed down version of the video, which the police have compiled. In the version that everybody saw today, which was the bad body cam, you cannot see in real time whether Adam had a gun in his hand. There is also another scene, a video from the school adjacent to the alley. In that video, you cannot see whether Adam had a gun in his hand. That video needs to be forensically analyzed, enhanced, and zoomed in to determine what, if anything, Adam had in his hand. Nevertheless, at the moment the officer
shot
him.
Are you saying he did not? I mean, you're his lawyer, his family's attorney. Do you know one way or the other if he had a gun in his hand? Because police say not only they found a gun, they also found gun residue on a glove he was wearing around his hand.
Well, the gun that was found was approximately 5 feet or more, 10 feet from Adam's body, number one. Gun residue is transferable.
Well, what does that tell you? I mean, it seems a big coincidence that there's a gun found right where he happened to stop. I mean.
Well, gun was found 5 to 10 feet from the body. Gun residue is transferable. The defendant, Ruben Roman, who was charged with unlawful use of a weapon, had red gloves in his hand, covered with gun residue. At this point, we don't know if the gun residue on Adam's hand was there when he passed away.
Well, what you're saying is we don't know if Adam fired the gun, which is what there would be residue of, I assume. I'm not an expert on this.
No. No, it is established that Ruben Roman fired that gun. It is also established that the magazine was empty. It is also established that the slide was opened. And it is also established that when Adam turned around, there was no gun in his hand.
Okay. But yet a gun was found right by his body, 5 to 10 feet away, throwing distance.
Correct.
So are you saying he did not have a gun? The only other option is that the associate he was being with, who is now in custody, placed that gun there previous to the police even arriving, and it's just a sheer coincidence that his body is found near that, correct?
At this time, there's nowhere to establish what, if anything, was in Adam's hand. It is not clear on the school video. It is not clear on the CPD video. All the images that we have thus far of Adam's right hand is blurry. So we cannot establish one way or another whether that child had the gun in his hand.
You've called this a, quote, assassination. Now, obviously, tensions are high in Chicago and Minnesota, elsewhere around the country. What makes you say that this is an assassination, which is a predetermined, planned out attempt to kill somebody?
Well, let's just establish one thing. This family, more than anything, wants peace in Chicago. This family has called for peace at every opportunity thus far. When I say it's an assassination, when the reporter, I believe, from Univision asked me about it, I have an unarmed 13-year-old child, the holy week of Easter, shot behind an alley with his hands in the air in the middle of his chest. He was given a directive from the officer, show me your hands. That child complied, lift up his hands, and was shot in the middle of his chest.
How is, I mean, I can't imagine, I was going to ask how the family is coping. Obviously, it is a beyond anything, it's the worst thing for any parent to go through. What is the family wanting to see happen as far as the police department and possibly even the courts are concerned?
The avenue legally will be disclosed at a later time, but they want justice for their family. They want reform. They want enhanced training for police officers. Obviously, this officer prematurely pointed the trigger at that young man when that young man complied, and then he shot him.
How do you determine that? You're saying you're not clear what's on the video, and yet you're coming to a conclusion.
No, everybody wants to pinpoint Adam with a gun in his hand. Nobody at this time can pinpoint Adam with a gun in his hand. We don't know what, if anything, he had in his hand. The video footage of the officer, he's running up and down. The video footage from Farragut School is from a great distance. It is zoomed and enhanced. So when you want to pin me down on what he had in his hand, I can't do that at this time.
Okay. Dina Weitz-Ortiz, I appreciate your time and your representation of this family. And again, I'm so sorry for this family's loss. It is
thank you.
It's awful. Joining us now, someone with experience running two major police departments in Philadelphia and D.C., CNN law enforcement analyst Charles Ramsey. Chief Ramsey, appreciate you being with us. I've watched this video. It is obviously horrific to see a 13-year-old boy shot and being attended to medically, and the video is just horrific. When you watch this video of the chase, all that we know has gone on, all that we've seen really just from this video and what police have said and what the family is saying, what do you see or what stands out to you?
Well, first of all, let me start by saying that it is a tragedy. Anytime someone loses their life, particularly a young person, it is a tragedy. But I, too, saw that video. In addition, I saw some other videos. I went to the Civilian Office of Police Accountability website that investigates these kinds of things for the Chicago PD, and they have several videos there. In my opinion, tragic as it was, the shooting was reasonable. And here's what I saw. There is a video that shows the young man and an adult, who is the 21-year-old, walking down a street together. Now, this is at 2:40 in the morning, 2:40 a.m., 13-year-old on the street with a 21-year-old at 2:40 in the morning. There's another shot that shows them walking down a street, and then they turn. You see a car going down the street. You can see the taillights. They turn toward the street. And then you hear a succession of shots, probably seven or eight shots. Those are the shots the shot spotter picked up. In addition to that, I listened to 911.
By the way, that shots fired. By the way, that shots fire thing you referenced, that is a program that they have in Chicago, which I was unaware of.
Right.
That basically it's a listening device that picks up when it picks up detects the sounds of gunfire. It alerts the police that there have been shots fired in an area, and that's what had this police officer respond.
Exactly. I had it in Philly in a couple spots, and I had it in D.C. as well. I'm very familiar with it. It's very effective. There's another video that is taken. It shows the two of them running immediately after the shots are fired. Then it picks up with the officer getting out of the car, running behind the individual, and you'll see when he comes across the adult, and he kind of goes by him, but his partner actually takes that person down. I saw that body cam as well. They get to the end of the alleyway, and he's again telling the young man to stop, you know, to turn around. And you can see there's a still shot with the young man he still has what looked to me like a gun in his right hand. And he suddenly spun around, and that's when the officer fired a single shot. Immediately after, The officer went there and began applying, you know, first aid, even CPR to the young man. There is a gun on the other side of the fence because there's an opening there. And the gun is on the other side, maybe about 5 feet. But when he spins around like that, if he had the gun in his right hand, that could have easily just flown right out of his hand, either as he was shot or he was trying to get rid of it right as he was shot. But it was less than a second, literally less than a second from the time the officer saw that gun in his hand to the time he fired that shot. I believe that's reasonable. I know right now everybody's, you know, blood in the water about policing. And I have not hesitated to speak up whenever officers inappropriately use force of any kind. This ain't one of those cases. I don't know how many people have ever chased an armed person down an alley at night. I have. And I know what it's like. Believe me.
We should point out there was a gun on the ground in that spot.
Yes.
Again, if he did not throw it there, unless then somebody else placed it there, and that there we're seeing this was all happening real time. The attorney, I don't know if she was suggesting that, you know, the 21-year-old may have used the gun and it could have been there.
No.
Just coincidentally, that seems unlikely. When I watched the video, not the slowed down version, but just which is important to watch in and of itself, but just the real time one, you do just get a sense of the split second involved here and in which a decision is made. And it just, you know, wherever you come down on this, it does give you a sense of the extreme difficulty of, you know, what a police officer is facing, what anybody in this scenario is facing. These things are, this in this case, it is happening so lightning fast late at night. It is a very difficult situation.
2:40 in the morning, 13 years old, out on the street with a guy with a gun. It's a tragic set of circumstances. And I'm not trying to victim blame, but sometimes people put themselves in awful bad positions. And so, you know, that time of morning, you got a gun, you're running. And if he had tossed it while he was running, you know, the video, of course, is bumpy because the video camera is actually in the chest of an officer. That's where they carry him. But you've jogged before. Anybody who's ever jogged and run, you know that when you're running, you're, as far as your head goes, it's relatively stable. It's in the body. It's when you start getting that motion.
Yeah.
So that officer was
difficult situation coming up next. Closing testimony. Make of the ex-officer's decision not to take the stand. And later, the congressman who sees mask wearing as a threat to personal freedom in his confrontation today with Dr. Anthony Fauci.
When do we get to the point?
In Minneapolis, crews have been putting up razor wire around police stations in preparation for a verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial. Police departments in Atlanta, Chicago, and Washington also taking precautions. Testimony ended today in court. Closing arguments will be heard on Monday. Tension, as you could see from those images, and as you might imagine, is running high. We'll have more now from Sarah Seidner.
I will invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege today.
For the first time since the start of the trial, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin spoke in court.
Do you feel that your decision not to testify is a voluntary one on your behalf?
Yes, it is.
He chose not to take the stand as a witness in his own defense, leading the defense to rest its case.
Your Honor, at this time, the defense rests.
The prosecution then brought back its star medical witness to refute the idea brought up by yesterday's defense expert.
It is an extremely toxic gas.
That exhaust from the squad car's tailpipe possibly led to carbon monoxide poisoning of George Floyd.
Do you agree with that proposition that's highlighted there?
No, I do not. It's simply wrong.
Just before that, the prosecution attempted to introduce new lab result evidence about carbon monoxide poisoning.
It was discovered yesterday by Dr. Baker. It would return a value for the carbon monoxide content and then would show whether or not that result is in the normal range or not.
The defense argued such a late evidence entry by the prosecution should lead to a mistrial.
It's our position that these new test results should not go in front of the jury, first and foremost. And second, if they were, I would be moving for a mistrial.
The judge agreed.
The late disclosure has prejudiced the defense. It's not going to be allowed.
A short time later, all witness testimony came to an end.
The state of Minnesota rests.
And Sarah Seidner joins us now along with George Floyd's brother, Terrence. Sarah?
Yeah, so we should mention, too, that the jury will get this case on Monday after closing arguments. But I am here with Terrence Floyd. Terrence, if you wouldn't mind coming over to talk to me, and I appreciate you being here. Why did you decide to come to this particular spot? This is the spot where Dante Wright was killed. The last time I saw you in person, it was at the spot where your brother was killed when you came into Minneapolis to pay your respects there. Why are you here today?
Well, we all know I'm in Minneapolis because of the child from my brother. But as we're here for that, this situation happened. So I thought it not robbery to come and just like I came down and pay respects to my brother where he passed away, where he got murdered, I wanted to do the same thing for Dante Wright. That's why I just felt compelled to come down here and just show him some love, show his family some love.
Could you have ever predicted or imagined that during the trial of a former officer accused of killing your brother for kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, that another young, unarmed black man would be shot dead by an officer just 10 miles away from what happened to your brother?
No, I couldn't. This is surreal. I couldn't have imagined this because during this time, you would think, you know, they would be low key, try to, like, you know, I said, dot every I, cross every T, and just do everything by the book. But yet, it's still, you know, accidents, unquote unquote, are still happening, and we're dying from it.
Do you believe that this was not an accident? Because you said accidents, quote unquote.
I seriously don't believe it's an accident because I'm not sure of the color of a taser in this part of town, but where I'm from, Brooklyn, New York, a taser is yellow and black, and a gun is black. So I don't think it was an accident because even besides the color, it's a weight difference. Other than that, besides it being a weight difference, they're positioned on different sides. So if you are a 26-year off, you've been on the force for 26 years, and you don't know by now which side to go to, you know, no, I really don't feel it was an accident, not at all.
Can you tell me what it was like the moment that you walked up to this memorial? You see Dante's name spelled out in candles. You have seen this scene before. That fist right there was taken from your brother's memorial. What was it like showing up here today?
It was like I said, like my nephew said, it was damn, this again moment. It happened again. And just walking up here, knowing his age, that could have been my son, because my son is 18. That could have been my son. And then It's just mind-boggling that, you know, the people that we are looking for protection from are actually using us, like, you know, being our predators. It seems like they're coming after us, you know, and that's the way I see it right now.
No, it's hard. No, you're okay. You're okay. I want to explain to you also why Terrence is so filled with emotion and at a loss for words. He literally just got a phone call. I hope you don't mind if I say.
Yes.
Just got a phone call from Dante Wright's mother. And he heard her voice and he said if his mother had been alive, George Floyd's mother had been alive, he heard his mother's voice in Dante Wright's mother as she was talking to him about the pain she felt, the death of her son. Anderson.
Sarah Seidner, thank you. And Terrence Floyd, thank you. Appreciate it. Our legal team has been helping us understand the courtroom proceedings from day one. Senior legal analyst and former federal prosecutor Laura Coates is with us, and criminal defense attorney Mark O'Mara. Mark, if you were representing Derek Chauvin, I assume you would have advised him to not to testify.
Though it's truly his decision at that moment in time, I've got to tell you that there was virtually nothing that Chauvin could have done to help himself in this case. I don't believe the only thing, and though I might have scripted it, he could never have gotten through it if he actually went out there and somehow apologized, somehow explained that he was based on his training, somehow came up with an explanation that might have convinced this jury to give him a lesser charge, but there was nothing he could have done to increase the chances of acquittal. And I think he would have been devastated on cross-examination by the prosecutor because there's no way that he can defend nothing other than the 9.5 minutes. So I think it was the right decision under these circumstances.
Lori, I don't know if one can generalize, but do prosecutors typically want to get a chance at cross-examining the defendant? Or in some instances, are they relieved when a defendant doesn't take a stand?
I mean, normally prosecutors are champing at the bit to be able to interview someone, let alone have a cross, because then you're able to bring up things that you otherwise could not get in. If there are prior bad acts, for example, I know that the judge in this case was not going to allow the overwhelming number of cases that they wanted, not that the number was overwhelming, but they wouldn't allow the majority of the actual prior bad acts of perhaps excessive force in other instances to get in. But if he opens a door and takes that stand, he's essentially fair game. So you want the opportunity as a prosecutor. I will say, as much as the defense is trying to plant a seed of doubt, one thing that defendants can do, which is very, very troublesome to a prosecutor, is they can plant a seed of empathy. Up until now, we've only heard from people who are doing no favors to try to make Derek Chauvin look bad. He did himself no favors. The 9-minute and 29-second video didn't no favors. But the idea of how people are psychologically trained in this country to give the benefit of a doubt to a police officer, even if they did not see a viable defense explanation, let alone justification, there is always an opportunity that somebody might see something about this individual in themselves, interpret his demeanor, his idiosyncrasies, his expressions in some way, his remorse, if he's able to demonstrate it. And they may be able to try to essentially attribute what they would feel on this person. That's the only real benefit you can have as a defendant in a case like this, to try to appeal to some sort of iota of empathy. Unfortunately, however, if he's not somebody who was going to be able to convey that, and the overwhelming evidence has been presented already, what could he possibly have said? He can't say he was trained to do this. He can't say he didn't know that the person was in distress. He can't say that he actually rendered aid. So what can he say?
Mark, looking at Monday, how much do closing arguments actually matter? I mean, can a case be won or lost by what lawyers say in their summations?
You know, I often say that closing arguments are really there for the lawyers because it's what we learned, you know, on TV and wanted to do in law school. But I will tell you, in a complicated case, and this case is complicated not because of the facts of the case. It's easy for us to say it looks like the state proved their case. And as laymen looking at it, it's pretty obvious. But what the defense has to focus on is nothing more than that jury has to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. And if the defense does their job of going through everything and showing up these potential other possibilities of cause of death, not that it happened that way. That's not the defense job. The defense's job is to say, if I can give you a reason, if I can give you a piece of evidence to which you can attach a doubt, and you have a reason for that, what it means is simply the state doesn't get their conviction because they have not proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. You are not deciding that my client is innocent. You are simply telling the prosecution you didn't do enough to take away all reasonable doubt. And that is the job of a criminal defense attorney in closing arguments.
Mark O'Mara, Laura Coates, stay with us. I appreciate it, Mark. Thanks very much. I want to get Laura's perspective on today's first court appearance for Kim Potter, the ex-police officer who shot and killed Dante Wright, and what direction her case could take. We'll be right back. With the pain still fresh and protesters again tonight taking to the streets of Brooklyn Center, the ex-police officer who shot and killed Dante Wright made her first court appearance today. Kim Potter was arrested yesterday, charged with second-degree manslaughter. Here again is seen as Miguel Marquez.
My brother and my sister need this woman to be convicted.
Dante Wright's aunt, Naisha, calling for the conviction of former Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter, who had her initial hearing today on a single charge of second-degree manslaughter.
Can we get something? Manslaughter?
Ben Crump, the lawyer for Dante Wright's family, says the 20-year-old father should never have been pulled over to begin with for expired tags, should never have even been threatened with a taser, and doesn't believe the former officer Potter, a 26-year veteran of the force, could mistake a handgun for a taser, as body cam video suggests.
They come up with a way to justify
over and over again, the killing of black people in America.
Dante Wright, he says, is only the latest victim of a justice system stacked against people of color.
And that's very important. That marginalized minorities in America get their day in court.
Wright's family says that Kim Potter was charged quickly is a step forward, but will never be enough.
Unfortunately, there's never going to be justice for us. The justice would bring our son home to us, knocking on the door with his big smile coming in the house.
Dante Wright's father says his son's life was only beginning to take shape.
My son was a good young man. He was a young man in the making. We were building my son up to be somebody. He was going to be somebody.
Speaking at the church where their son will be eulogized next week, speaking just before going to the funeral home to see their son's body for the first time since he was killed, his 14-year-old sister speaking about her brother.
My brother, he was the most delightful person I've ever met. Like, he was everything. Everything. His smile, his jokes, his everything about him.
And Miguel Marquez joins us now from Brooklyn Center. So what is next for the Wright family, Miguel?
It's a big family, and I've met some of the siblings, and they are absolutely lovely and absolutely shocked at what they are dealing with now. You know, it was really moving being in that church where his funeral will be next week, and that's the big thing that they're moving toward now. They were going to the funeral home today to see his body for the first time since he died, and they are preparing for that funeral that'll be next Thursday. At that same church. It is an incredibly hard time for them. It's so hard to see the father of Dante Wright get up and speak. He had a very difficult time saying anything but wanted to speak on behalf of his son. Anderson? Mm-hmm.
Miguel Marquez, appreciate it. Thank you. Back with us as well now, CNN senior legal analyst Laura Coates. Laura, you heard Dante Wright's aunt call for the conviction of the former police officer Potter. Do you have any sense of how the course of this, and how will it tough or easy would it be for prosecutors to deliver that verdict for the Wright family?
Well, you know, the definition of justice, unfortunately, for so many families of victims in this country is just not in line with what the laws can provide, especially when it means and come to the sentencing. But having said that, even without that universal definition of justice, Anderson, there is a charge now against this officer. And as I've said before, because of the pace of this actual charge, it could mean this is only the initial charge. I remind people that another officer in the Minneapolis area just a couple years ago, Mohammed Noor, was also charged with this second-degree manslaughter, but they also had a third-degree murder charge attached to it based on the same factual predicate of this unreasonable risk that was taken. And the unreasonable risk here is when you've created an opportunity where you could actually consciously cause somebody to die or have grave bodily harm. The question that comes down to is how they're going to be able to reconcile this notion of consciously. Is the fact that the taser is so markedly different from the service weapon going to be enough to infer that there was consciousness? Remember, the words that we choose in a statute are very deliberate, and they have meaning. They're not just sort of terms you throw out there. And so they'll have to go and develop the case to figure out if they're going to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that even if it wasn't an intentional act, if all of the circumstances surrounding it showed this was a consciously taken, unreasonable risk, you could elevate these charges. Now, I'll just say this, though, Anderson. Remember, one of the things that's very disturbing about officers when they are involved in these cases as potential defendants is they get the opportunity to preempt a lot of this. When that now resigned police chief got up there, he set the stage and the tone of what people believed or were led to believe. He called it an accidental discharge. With that out there in the universe, the prosecutors have to try to figure out if that's truthful or if that is only part of the story or an outright lie. This investigation for them has just really begun.
And the Wright family suggested it wants to see much more jail time than this case, as it now stands, could potentially result in. Do you think second-degree manslaughter is the appropriate charge, given what's known at the time?
Well, given what's known at the time, without any information about the idea of acting with a depraved heart in some respect, which of course also has some legal connotations, this is a good initial charge. Now, again, this is a sliding scale for many prosecutors. And I remind people, another officer, Geronimo Yanez, who shot and killed Philando Castile, also had this same charge of second-degree manslaughter. And they added two additional lower charges, where the Mohamed Noor case increased one. So depending upon how all of this is going in the investigation, it is the appropriate charge initially, but that does not mean by any stretch of the imagination that it needs to be the final charge. Particularly, you have to think about the entire course of events here, from the time he was pursued to stopped to this officer intervening to now having the service weapon instead of the taser. All of this comes into the same statement we've looked at the Derek Chauvin trial, which is the reasonable use of force. If that wasn't followed, the sliding scale goes up in terms of the degree of the charge, whether it's manslaughter or murder.
Laura Coates, I appreciate it. Thank you. Up next, we have breaking news on the vaccine front, why some may need a third shot this year, and a fiery exchange today on Capitol Hill between Dr. Anthony Fauci and Congressman Jim Jordan. We'll be right back. There's breaking news tonight on the coronavirus vaccine front. The CEO of Pfizer says that a third shot of its vaccine will likely be needed within a year of the original shot. In a live event on Facebook, he also said there will probably be a need for an annual COVID shot. All this as there was a remarkably heated exchange today on Capitol Hill between Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert and the chief medical advisor to President Biden, and the conservative Republican congressman from Ohio, Jim Jordan. It took place during a House subcommittee meeting about the government's response to the pandemic and Jordan's attacks on the restrictions still in place around the country. CNN's Caitlin Collins now joins us with more. So talk about what happened today between the congressman and Dr. Fauci.
Anderson, it kind of looked like, I think, what probably so many of us have seen or experienced over the last year, a fight between your family or your friends over COVID-19 restrictions, vaccinations, mask wearing, what's going on, something that's really become a part of our daily life, except this time it was happening on Capitol Hill during a hearing with a congressman and the nation's top infectious diseases expert as they were openly sparring over this issue of these restrictions, where Jim Jordan started questioning Dr. Fauci during this hearing, a hearing where some of the lawmakers were using it to get answers about what's been going on. But Jim Jordan took this route of complaining about how, you know, a year ago you saw Vice President Mike Pence and President Trump announcing this 15 days to slow the spread and saying that it turned into too many days of restrictions. And of course, Dr. Fauci pushing back on the reason why those restrictions really stayed in place. But you kind of just had to watch it to get it. So just look at what happened earlier today on Capitol Hill.
What objective outcome do we have to reach before Americans get their liberty and freedoms back?
You know, you're indicating liberty and freedom. I look at it as a public health measure to prevent people from dying and going to the hospital.
You don't think Americans' liberties have been threatened the last year, Dr. Fauci? They've been assaulted. Their liberties have.
I don't look at this as a liberty thing, Congressman Jordan.
Well, that's obvious.
I look at this as a public health thing.
But I disagree with you on that. So I just want to know, when do Americans get their First Amendment liberties back?
You know, I don't think anything was censured because they felt they couldn't disagree with me. I think you're making this a personal thing, and it isn't.
It's not a personal thing.
No, you are. That is exactly what you're doing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want you to answer my question. The American people want Dr. Fauci to answer the question. What does it have to be?
Expire, sir. If you need to respect the chair and shut your mouth.
That's Maxine Waters there at the end saying to shut your mouth to Jim Jordan. But you see how heated it got. And really what Dr. Fauci was saying in the end was that it has to be that the more people get vaccinated, the lower level a threat of getting infected with COVID-19 is. That's when life can get back to normal, he said.
Did things calm down after that or did they clash again?
Nope, they clashed again. It's really kind of become a routine thing that you've seen happen with Dr. Fauci and some of these Republicans, a lot of them big allies of former President Trump, in these hearings where they are going back and forth on these restrictions. And you hear Dr. Fauci and they're asking for these direct, exact numbers and exact science. And I think often in briefings, you've seen some of the public health experts be hesitant to say, here's exactly where we need to be, because there's so much that's unpredictable about COVID-19 with the variants and whatnot. And this is often something you see happen at these hearings, especially with Dr. Fauci, given, of course, he was often a favorite target of former President Trump's. And so, no, it continued from there with them clashing again over this idea of this liberty versus lives lost. One thing I think we should note is that Republican men have been increasingly hesitant to get the vaccine. That's been a really important messaging aspect that we've heard from COVID-19 experts, people who work in the White House, people who don't work in the White House about that. And so that is certainly an avenue that other people could explore to help end the pandemic, help end these restrictions that you've been seeing.
Yeah, Caitlin Collins, appreciate it. Thanks. Just ahead, President Biden signaling a tougher stance against Russia than his predecessor, with new sanctions against the country. Also, new detail connecting the Trump 2016 campaign with Russia. Both stories when we continue. The sanctions against Russia announced today by President Biden punish banks, businesses, and individuals for actions against the country, against the United States, stretching back to at least 2016. They also announced a president who, unlike his predecessor, is willing to criticize and punish Russia, as well as hold out an olive branch.
We could have gone further, but I chose not to do so. I chose to be proportionate. The United States is not looking to kick off a cycle of escalation and conflict with Russia. We want a stable, predictable relationship. If Russia continues to interfere with our democracy, I'm prepared to take further actions to respond.
We're now from our Alex Marquardt on the message the president believes he's sending to Russia's Vladimir Putin with these sanctions, as well as new revelations about how Russia meddled in the past two U.S. elections.
Today, the Biden administration rolled out what the president calls measured and proportionate punishment against Russia for, among other things, Russia's attempt to interfere in the 2020 presidential election and the historic hack against the U.S. government. The massive Russian influence campaign in the 2020 election led to 32 people and entities being sanctioned today, including for the use of disinformation websites like these, spreading lies, directed by Russia's main intelligence agencies. Russian efforts and operations were global, a network in Africa and companies in Pakistan. There was a new tie revealed today between the Trump campaign in 2016 and Russia. The U.S. Treasury Department targeting Russian Konstantin Kalimnik for giving Russian intelligence both polling data and campaign strategy in that race. It was given to him by 2016 Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, a longtime associate of Kalimnik's. Manafort pushed his own conspiracy theories, promoting the idea that Ukraine, not Russia, interfered in the 2016 election, an unfounded idea picked up by President Trump.
How come the FBI never got the server from the DNC? The server, they say, is held by a company whose primary ownership individual is from Ukraine.
For the first time today, the U.S. also named the Russian intelligence agency behind the unprecedented cyber attack known as the SolarWinds hack, uncovered late last year. A sophisticated campaign into at least nine U.S. federal agencies and around 100 companies. Cracking down on Russian intelligence, the Biden administration sanctioned six technology companies connected to them and announced it would kick out 10 Russian diplomats from the embassy in Washington, including known spies. One issue where Russia was not punished is for the reported bounties that Russia put on the heads of American troops in Afghanistan, reports that Biden used during the campaign to blast Trump.
As president, I will never, never, never stand silently in the face of intelligence reports that the Kremlin has put bounties on the heads of U.S. troops serving Afghanistan.
The intelligence on that, Biden officials now say, isn't strong enough to demand action now. Instead, they'll respond through diplomats and the military.
And Alex Marquardt joins us now. President Biden said today that he told Vladimir Putin earlier this week that the U.S. action was coming. What more do we know about that call?
Well, he said this call with Putin was candid and respectful. He says he told Putin that the U.S. response came after they had decided that what Russia had done was, in his words, totally inappropriate. He said he told Putin that more action against Russia could come if Russia continues to interfere. Now, Anderson, Biden's clearly trying to walk a careful line here, both punishing Russia for many of the things they've done while also hoping that things don't escalate between the U.S. and Russia. The phrase that we heard from Biden today that we've frankly heard a lot from this White House is stable and predictable. That's the relationship that they want with Russia going forward. Biden talked about how these two great powers, as he called them, can continue to work together, like on nuclear issues and arms control. And Biden also proposed a face-to-face summit with Putin in Europe this summer. Anderson.
Alex Marquardt, I appreciate it. Thanks. The news continues. I want to hand it over to Chris for Cuomo Primetime. Chris?
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.